Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And welcome back, genies, for another edition of Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth, on the show where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. I am excited today because we're going to take a little southern slant with Karen Clifford. Karen has written books, she's a teacher, and she's done a lot of research in the South. And I know we got a lot of followers in the South, and we're going to get into that and find out how different it really is there. No, not all the courthouses are burned. No, not all the records are gone. Karen's going to fill you in on how to track down those missing and difficult Southern ancestors. That's coming up in about 8 minutes. Later in the show, we're going to talk to a man in Pennsylvania who bought a cemetery. Yeah, why? Why would he do this? What's he doing with it? We'll talk to Roy Scheffler about his experience coming up a little bit later on. But right now, of course, it is time to check in with our good friend David Allen Lambert, Chief Genealogist for the New England Historic Genealogical Society and American Ancestors in Boston. Hi, David. How are you?
Hey, Fish, I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I am doing awesome. Of course, still refreshed from my little excursion up to Alaska.
That makes reference to an email that you sent me with a photograph of you with a totem pole.
Yes. And, you know, I didn't even know that they put family history on totem poles until I was there. It was amazing.
Well, it's amazing. Now, that wasn't an ancestor by any chance.
No.
Okay. Well, one thing that may be an ancestor is something that was found back in the 1890s that directly links to the Northwest totem poles. This is a 9-foot wooden idol that was found back in 1890 in a peat bog in Siberia. Now, the thing about this is older than you might believe. It is actually 11,000 years old.
Ooh, 9,000 BC, really?
Amazing, isn't it?
How'd they figure this out?
They've used radiocarbon dating, and because of this, we know it's 11,000 years old, which actually makes it twice as old as the Great Pyramids of Giza.
Wow.
The nice thing about this is that this actually gives a nice link between the time when the Native Americans are coming across the Bering Land Bridge into North America, and of course the traditions, as you've seen recently, of the Northwest with totem poles ties perfectly to this tradition in Siberia, which is 11,000 years ago.
Boy, that is just an incredible find. I love hearing this stuff. Every week there's something new.
It really is exciting.
Or old.
It's nice to know that old news becomes new for
yes.
Something found that long ago. Well, some new news is going on in Fort Wayne, Indiana, at the Allen County Public Library. You may have visited this wonderful facility.
It's like the number two biggest in the world to the one in Salt Lake City.
That's very true. And they are having a $100,000-plus renovation of the 2,000-square-foot downtown center. It's going to make genealogists a lot happier. It's going to go on in November, so there'll probably be some disruption of service. So check out their website to find out what's going on before you head down to Fort Wayne.
That's great news for Midwesterners.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's funny. I often don't talk about my own dirty laundry, but one of my black sheep ancestors, which I may have talked to you about, my own grandfather. And at NEHGS, we just did a little video, which is up on YouTube, of a photograph. Remember a couple weeks ago we talked about the alien registration files?
Yeah, those are great.
Within that file, I found the only photograph that we have of my grandfather.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's a little passport-sized photo, has a signature on it, but because I have no other photographs, I cherish this probably as much as anything I do in my genealogical collection. But the ironic thing is I found it a year to the week my father died.
Oh.
And it was his dad. He always said, you know, Dave, can you find what happened to my father? He disappeared. Unfortunately, I think this bootlegger and person who sidestepped the law quite a bit died on the streets of Boston.
You think or you know?
I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
He died as a John Doe. He isn't in any records that I've found. But this is a nice little video, and you get to see how much I don't look like my grandfather.
Well, let's link that video to our Facebook page from ExtremeGenes.com. That sounds great.
Yep, I'd be glad to do that. We have some exciting news at NEHGS. We have a Labor Day experience for September 2nd to September 9th. We're offering to our guest users census, tax, and voter lists over 40 separate databases. Those are going to be free to our guest users. And that leads me to a tech tip that you may have never tried. Have you? Well, you probably have. Ever drawn the floor plan of your childhood home?
It is so bizarre you would say that. I was thinking about this just a couple of nights ago because I have all these photographs from around our house, indoors and outdoors, and I thought it would be kind of fun to take some of them and put them together and basically take a tour of the house and then perhaps draw the layout of exactly, you know, how it all was and where the shelves were and where this was and where that was. It would be quite fun, I think.
Well, I think with graph paper, but now with CAD programs that are pretty reasonable in price, you could probably lay out the floor plan. Like if you were going to do a renovation of your house, how about doing a recreation of your old house?
Right. Or your grandfather's house.
Exactly. Or interview somebody and sit down and have them draw out where the kitchen was, where the bedrooms were, who slept in what room. Great stuff. And last but not least, my weekly tech tip is an iPhone and Android app called PhotoMine, spelled PhotoMyne. This for $4.99 is a great little app. I'm going to download it and I'll give you a review next week. You can take pictures of your photo albums. You know the magnetic ones your pictures are stuck in and you're afraid to lift out of?
The 70s. Yeah, what a great time. Who was thinking when they made those things?
Not archivist, obviously. But the one thing about it is you're able to scan the pages, and then it does auto and color and contrast corrections. So those faded pictures from the 50s, 60s, and 70s come to life again, and then you can use social media to post them and share them with your family.
So we're talking with the cell phone.
With a cell phone, a cheap app for $4.99. I have an album from the 70s that I'm going to use and upload to Facebook, and I'll do it as my test.
He's David Allen Lambert, Chief Genealogist for the New England Historic Genealogical Society and American Ancestors. Thank you, David. Talk to you again next week.
Very good. Have a good week yourself.
And coming up next, we're going to talk to a woman who knows all about the trials of researching in the South in the 19th century. How are you going to get to your people in each state? Karen Clifford has some ideas for you. Coming up in minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show and ExtremeGenes.com. And welcome back to Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show and ExtremeGenes.com. Fisher here, the radio root sleuth with my guest, Karen Clifford. She is president of Genealogy Research Associates Incorporated. She's an author of a book called Digging Deeper, Using Essential Pre-1850 Records. She teaches college classes. I mean, I can't even imagine how you found the time to come on with us, Karen.
It's because you caught me at home. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, we have so many listeners in the South, and of course, those people who have Southern roots, that I thought it would be important to talk about how to get back there. Because as we always hear, oh, all the courthouses were burned during the Civil War. Well, I can't believe that they all were, but there's a lot of missing records. Tell us about what we need to know about researching in the South.
First of all, it's very helpful if you have a clear understanding of the history of each state.
Okay.
So if you find out from a census record that your ancestor was in Georgia, then you need to go online and find out what records still exist for Georgia. Are there any that you have to be careful of? Because in Georgia, the federal census records up to 1830 were lost, and so you know you're going to have to use something like a substitute record.
All right. And what kind of records are out there like that?
Well, a substitute record for a census is another type of enumeration, which is a tax list.
Right.
So you can use tax lists to pinpoint an ancestor in a particular place at a particular time. And that is more like a regional record, too, because sometimes they're federal tax records, and sometimes they're a regional tax record, and sometimes they're a county or local if it's a town. That's not the case in Georgia. Mostly they're by county. However, the federal government was dealing with a lot of people in the South who were returning from serving in the military. They had pensions that had to be forwarded. For example, they may have lived in Maryland or Virginia or North Carolina or receiving a federal pension in those states, so they had to inform the federal government that they'd moved. So then you would look in those indexes for those people. Another thing is churches recorded many vital records. In the South, you have the Baptists, the Methodists, even the Quakers for a time were in the South. Later, they were going to be moving up because of their stand on slavery.
Right. Now, tell me, were a lot of the churches lost during the Civil War?
No. One of the reasons that they're so devastating when you read about them is, for example, when Sherman came through the United States and went down. He went. He made this path right through to South Carolina. And in South Carolina, it was so disastrous because the South Carolinians were the only state in the Union that kept all their records in a centralized repository in Charleston.
Oh, boy.
The counties didn't, they really didn't have their individual courthouse system set up until after the Civil War. And so in their fear of this whole group of people coming in, the South Carolinians burned their own records in some cases so they wouldn't fall into the hands
of the enemy.
Of the enemy.
Right.
And so sometimes people took records and they buried them, or they just took them somewhere for safekeeping if they had the time to. I know of instances where during the Civil War records were stored in a courthouse outside of Virginia and sent to West Virginia for safekeeping. And it wasn't until years after the fact that someone discovered that they were in the courthouse and finally gave it back to the county that it belonged to.
Isn't there an assumption, Karen? I think that a lot of people feel like, well, like in New England or the North, there were a lot of the vital records that were going on in the 19th century. It doesn't sound like that was going on in the South at all to begin with.
That's right. And that's one of the understandings it's nice to know about, because you could waste a lot of time looking for a record that doesn't exist.
So what's the solution to all this?
Well, one of the general ways that we try to solve these problems is to look at manuscript collections. These are papers that archives have kept over the centuries of the original writings of people. I've held in my hand old farmers' almanacs where someone in the community had cut and pasted from an old newspaper that doesn't exist anymore news of someone's marriage or a death.
Wow.
Or a birth in the family. They glued them on those pages because they couldn't afford to pay for scrapbooks. And they made their own paste, you know, from flour and water. And then they stored all this. In fact, I've had clients who've given me these books to index because they've passed down in their family, and they wanted to know if there really was anything in this whole book that had anything to do with their family or if it was just a hobby that great-grandma had.
That's incredible.
Oh, I am a firm believer. I'm one of those optimists, and I think you have to be an optimist or you don't even start looking. But I'm a firm believer, having worked in the field for so many years now, that these records are out there. And we have to look at the unusual places, such as loose papers in an archive or a manuscript collection, which could be in the historical society. Every state in the South has a archive. It also has a historical society, and they almost always have a state library.
Wow.
Those are the three places that I look. State libraries mostly have published materials, but they have guides that lead you to these other two sources.
We've got a lot of listeners in Alabama. Can you speak to that state a little bit?
Yes. One of the things that you have to realize is the Gulf South states are being brought up, being trained how to do their records by the people in South Carolina and Georgia, because South Carolina existed earlier. So sometimes understanding how they dealt with issues. There are laws that are passed in each state that tell you who is the next person to take over a probate, for example, if the eldest son has died? Because you'd wonder, you find a probate record on your ancestor, and it doesn't specifically give that ancestor's relationship. Person has the same last name.
Right.
And so you're trying to figure out what could prove this. Well, you go to a law library or something that has the legal statutes for the time period, and you find out who was supposed to take it over because the courts would follow that guideline. So a good thing for beginners to do, or even intermediate researchers, is get your hands on a good genealogy how-to book or a historical book that cover the state you're interested in.
Right.
And the people from Alabama, they don't stay a long time. The people in Georgia, they didn't stay a long time because their state was giving away land in these land lotteries. And so you have a family with five brothers, they'd be in one county, the next thing you know, they'd be in three states. Because they were given opportunities to go somewhere else. They didn't like that land that much, so they sold it to someone for a little bit more money. They went to the next good land that was being given away.
And so how would you trace these people, Karen?
Land records and lottery records. and every census record you can get your hand on.
Boy.
And tax records. There's several quirks about every state, and that's why it's not easy to just give someone a carte blanche. This will help you on your research.
So when we talk about the South, we're talking about basically a confederation. It's almost like the Confederacy all over again, right? Each state a little bit different, the whole thing very different than the North.
That's right. In fact, when I teach my students in college, I let them know the regions of the United States, as far as genealogy goes, were set up based on the political jurisdictions that were around them. Because if you learn how to do court records, say, in New York, you're talking about guardianship records, and they're named something, the Orphans Court.
Right.
And they're a traveling court. But what do you do when you get to South Carolina when there's not even counties? Well, they have legal jurisdictions, but they gathered all their records down to Charleston. People then think, well, everything's destroyed, because when they talk to the courthouse, the court said, well, we didn't have records that early, or they were destroyed, when they never had them at all.
In the first place.
Don't know that.
Right.
Because the clerks are brand new, and they just are given a piece of paper, say, we don't have records from this time. But if you take the initiative and you study the history, you'll find out what is missing. I'm sorry, I have this little problem of trying to remember if it's Arkansas or Alabama. One of those two states have a wonderful pattern of doing their history on a regional level. So they will talk about five or six counties that are all clustered together. And that was for a reason. Those people live close enough that they could share each other's knowledge. You know what it's like when a whole bunch of people move into a new area and they don't have the lawns put in, and they don't have...
Right.
you don't even know where to get your water. Well, this is what's happening with our ancestors. They're coming from settled places, and they're going into the South, and nothing is all set up for them yet. So you have to think, where would this ancestor go to get something approved? What court would they go to? Court records are just marvelous at this time, because they were also fighting with each other over water rights. And so sometimes the land disputes are some of the best way we can get information.
Wow.
The other problem in Alabama and Arkansas, there's property in there that was being given up by territories. And so the records are at a federal level.
So they're all over the place. Wow. It sounds enormously complicated.
It is. It seems really, really complicated. I keep saying one of these days I'm going to write a book on that, but I'm getting kind of old. So I leave on to my students, learn what you learn, and you become the professional researcher that they need to be if they stick with it in their state or where their ancestors moved. Because today we're all moving into DNA.
Right.
And having those tools together are solving problems most people would not have been able to do a few years ago.
Isn't that the truth? Karen Clifford, thank you so much for your insight on Southern research. And you're right. When we get the DNA together with the records that are there, a lot of these things should be resolved.
Yes.
All right. Thanks for coming on.
You're welcome.
And coming up next, maybe you're one of those people who really enjoys cemeteries. But do you enjoy them enough to actually go out and buy one? We're going to talk to a man in Pennsylvania next who has done just that on America's Family History Show, Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. And we are back on America's Family History Show, Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth. And you know, there are a lot of people in America, I think many people even listening right now, who are interested in cemeteries. I think they're great places to go, a lot of history to be found there, obviously a lot of family history and memories and touching feelings as well. But there are not a lot of people who take that passion and actually go out and buy their own cemetery. But the man on the line with us right now from Pennsylvania has done just that. Roy Scheffler on the line from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. How are you, Roy?
Hi, Scott. Well, I'm doing just fine here in steamy eastern Pennsylvania. Thanks.
Now, tell us about this. This was about 7-8 years ago that you decided it's time to pick up a 7-acre cemetery. This isn't even your living. You've never worked for a funeral home, but you are a passionate genie, a genealogist. Tell us about this whole experience and why you decided to do it.
Well, two primary reasons. I got started in genealogy in around 2004. And then promptly my company dispatched me to Wisconsin for 2.5 years, where I was living the bachelor life in an efficiency apartment, and I had all the time in the world to do my family research. And around 2007, I decided to query the cemetery where I thought that my great-grandmother was buried, and it happened to be the Fairview Cemetery, which is the one I now own. And the response I got from the owner at the time was, your grandmother's not here. And I said, it says her on the death certificate, she's buried at Fairview. And he says, I have no records of that. So I thought, how do you force the records to reveal themselves? And it was a struggle. And I left it go for a while. And then I came back home for a visit. And when I came, my mom said, the cemetery's not looking so good. And I said, really? Because she used to visit my father and some of our relatives. And I said, So about that time I got home into Wisconsin, I got a call from the owner, and he said, I'm losing interest, Roy. And I said, I see that. The grass is up at 10 inches. The city was about to come in and tell him he had to, mow it. And he said, remember when you said you wanted to buy it? And I said, you're absolutely correct. I did ask you that in 1994 when you buried my father, because I was a little bit, uneasy at the whole arrangement.
Sure.
And I have no idea what compelled me to say, if you ever want to sell this, you let me know. And he remembered it. And then he called me on it. And the guy that I am, I said, well, let's meet. So the next time I was back in town, September of 07, we met at the cemetery, stood in the circle. And I said, well, I'm new at this. What do we do? What do you got? And he said, well, I made him an offer. And he goes, okay, let's go sign the papers.
Whoa.
That was it.
That was it. First of all, what kind of work do you do, Roy?
Well, I'm a business and a design engineer.
Okay. And so you got into this. And what happened now? You take over the cemetery in Pennsylvania. You've got family there. There are records missing, obviously, or at least that they hadn't given to you. What have you discovered since you took the whole thing over?
Well, that was then the beginning of the interesting parts, of course, as I dug deeper. And as you know, yourself being a genealogist, you make the connections, and before you know it, of course, now my wife was a local gal in a sense. So then I start doing her genealogy, and then I come to find between us, I'm counting maybe 100 people. And
wow.
That are interred and that are still to be interred, that have, like my mother, her name's already engraved on the stone. She's still alive. So she needed to go there, and it's sort of unfolded.
Harder than you thought to take care of it?
It's intense, I got to say. I probably need to write a book or do some YouTube videos because of what I've learned along the way. And, one of the things I did hone my skills with early on then is the art of divining with coat hangers.
Does it really work, divining?
Absolutely. In fact, my grave digger, he's about ready to throw his probe away, because when he comes out to dig, and I said, well, Bobby, we got a tough one here. I said, there's no good land references. I said, so I've divined it already, and I put these little markers here. Let's see what you find. Then invariably he goes, Roy, yeah, no need for me to probe anymore. You're always right on the money. So, I do that. I've done that on quite a few occasions, located graves of people that, were essentially, because the record keeping was so poor by the previous owners, I had to do a lot of CSI work, a lot.
Wow. How many people do you have in the cemetery?
Well, there's over 4,000 standing monuments, but the records from the 1910s and then through the 1918 Spanish influenza, there are so many people that are just written in a contiguous log. There's no stones or markers. I'm guessing I could be up to 5,000.
And so you're trying to find out who they all are by going through the death records from that time and place.
Yeah, it's little by little, and through serendipity, I'll get an inquiry, and then that'll lead me down a trail, and then I make another discovery. And as I do this, of course, I record everything in my software package, and I'm a records maniac, and the integrity of the records is important, of course. And I absolutely did find my great-grandmother on one of those pages. There was an entry, and, of course, the previous owner didn't take the time to look. She's in an unmarked grave as well.
And so you don't know where she is exactly.
Well, I do. It turned out, that her one son died in 1942, and his grave, after a lot of triangulation, is right next to her unmarked grave.
Ah. Well, tell us about the Hilfiker sisters.
Well, they're right outside my front door. I literally walk out my front door 40 feet across it's an avenue, and they're the first three stones on the corner of the drive and the main road. And, you know, I sit there and I eat my breakfast. I look out the window, and I see these polished little gems. And when the wind blows and the flowers fly, some of these silk flowers, you know, they take loft and they land, you know, and I don't know where they belong. So I would tell my grandchildren, go out and pick up the flowers and put all the errant flowers on the Hilfiker girls, because nobody remembers them. Died in the late 1800s.
Right, and they were little girls.
They were little. I think one-year-old, two-year-old, and 5 years old. And they were the first three children from this family, and they had five more after that. I can't imagine your first three children perishing, and then you continue and had five more that lived to adulthood, which was good for them. I mean,
sure.
But that would have been discouraging.
We're talking to Roy Scheffler in Pennsylvania. He bought a cemetery, the Fairview Cemetery. I guess we could call it a hobby, Roy, since you're not really in any profitable situation with this, right?
No, that's correct. I fought tooth and nail to become a 501c13 nonprofit corporation. I'm registered in the state of Pennsylvania.
Do you have a lot of the space left?
Well, I have about 500 spaces left. I do about 18 burials a year between full vaults and cremation. On average, I would say. But invariably, when I'm traveling for my work, which I do a lot, I'll get that call, and then I have to, you know, pull out all the stops and try to find where to tell the gravedigger to dig. So that's been a little problematic, but, you know, in today's age of information, I armed myself with thumb drives and remote servers, and I made my own cloud so I can go up there and grab as much as I can remotely to help out while I'm away.
Well, I'm certain there have got to be some families who are enormously appreciative of all you've done to restore the integrity of the cemetery. Tell me a story of something that's touched your heart a little bit since you've taken over.
Yeah, I got some emails that were forwarded to me from the newspaper. Really kind words. A local high school teacher actually said to the paper that they'd love to see more of these positive stories on the front page, you know, than you know, the user run-of-the-mill stuff. And she said that she wasn't even aware that I was here, and she teaches 1 mile away, so she was going to go out of her way the first day of school to come by and, you know, take a look-see. So, I mean, I'm getting all kinds of, you know, really positive responses and thank yous, and again, serendipity's really kicking in.
Not many people follow their passion to this degree. Roy Scheffler, enjoy your cemetery, and thanks for what you're doing. I think it's important work.
Thank you, Scott.
And coming up next, Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com talks preservation on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. Welcome back to Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Fisher here with Tom Perry right over there. Wave to the people, Tom.
Hey!
He is our preservation authority from TMCPlace.com. And Tom, interesting, we got an email from Jan Draxler in Savannah, Georgia, asking about microphones. And she's apparently going to a family reunion and wants to know what kind of microphone would work best for video and for audio to interview some of the older family members and get their stories.
You know, that's a really good question, especially it's a timely question, because even though we're a few months out from the holidays, you need to start thinking right now about doing holiday gifts for your family history type stuff, preservation things. And audio recording is something that's really important. I remember back in the day, people used to always ignore audio, say, oh, we'll fix it in the mix. Oh, we'll fix it here. We'll do this. And it's like, what? So that's why I went to Full Sail University and got an audio engineering certification, so I could understand more about audio, even though video was my mainstay. There's so many different kinds of microphones. The wrong microphone can mess things up. If you have a group of people sitting around a table, it's going to be different than interviewing two people sitting next to each other. So that's a really good question right now. Let's talk about some different kinds of microphones. The first one I want to talk about is called an omnidirectional. It's omni, meaning all the way around. So if you have a group of people sitting around in chairs and you want a microphone in the middle of them to get whatever sounds come out, an omnidirectional is the best because it's going to pick up everything from every side.
But the downside would be, of course, it's going to pick up a lot of room noise.
Exactly. It's going to pick up everything. Now, one thing, you'll never see one of these like in a church, because the churches have speakers in them also, and you will get feedback. You'll get the sound and all those kind
sure.
of bad things. So you need to be really careful. And as you mentioned, it will pick up everything. So you want to make sure you're in a quiet room. And again, which we've talked about in previous segments, make sure whether you're recording it on a cassette player, as weird as that sounds, or your iPhone, make sure you put on headphones. And before you start recording, have everybody talk, sing Mary Had a Little Lamb, something, because you want to be able to know exactly what's actually being heard by your device, whether it's a camcorder or a cassette recorder or one of those new HDD recorders, anything like that. Because you might hear a little hum from the air conditioner that you didn't hear normally because your ear said, hey, I don't need to hear that. I want to listen to Aunt Martha, what she's saying.
And then you have the issue of indoors and outdoors. If you're outdoors, you're going to pick up wind. You're going to pick up children running around in the playground nearby. Same on the indoors. You don't want anybody else in the room walking around while this interview is going on.
Exactly, because we have trained our brains not to listen to stuff like that, especially if you've raised children. And so you just totally turn them off. Even if you're not recording, go into your bedroom at night and just sit there with nothing supposedly on and listen, and you will hear things that you never knew existed before.
Right, because we do tune it out.
That's why an omnidirectional microphone is very limited in its uses. You can do simple things like if you have some bar stools, put them around and throw a blanket over them. Because the biggest thing is you're going to hear echoes. Most rooms have the four walls, the ceiling, and the floor, and you're going to hear all kinds of echoes. If somebody moves a little bit, somebody's smacking their lips or chewing gum or clipping their fingernails, anything, you're going to hear it. The omnidirectional will pick it up.
Oh, boy. Aren't most video camera microphones omnidirectional, Tom?
No, most of them are kind of more of a bidirectional, and some of them are even shotgun, like the ones that are built on top of a camcorder.
Right.
The good ones are usually shotgun. Let's move into the shotgun microphones. A shotgun is like a shotgun. So it kind of goes out in a direction, but it spreads out. So it's not straight. It kind of goes out. So if there's several people sitting there, like two or three people sitting together, you have a shotgun. It kind of goes out as you would imagine a shotgun shooting pellets would go out. So pick up all those people. So anything on the sides or behind you aren't going to be picked up.
We mentioned earlier the omnidirectional mics. Now we're talking about the shotgun mics that kind of open up and spread the little further out they get. But that'll keep some of the noise out, right, Tom?
Oh, absolutely. Any noise behind you, any noise at the side will go away. Like if you look at a shotgun microphone, you'll see the mic element on the very front, and you'll see all these slats on the side. What those slats are, they take anything that's reverberating off the walls, they go into there, and they see, oh, hey, the same signal is coming from the front, and they cancel out its own reflection.
Wow.
So it lets the strong signal come in, and you send A, B, C, D, E, F, G, but then the ones that are echoing off the walls come in, and it says, hey, this is the same thing. This is a weaker signal. I don't want this. So the wave patterns cancel each other out, so you get the strong ones coming from the front. That's usually what you kind of see on microphones, like at a church pulpit as well.
Right. And, you know, I remember I have one of these old Christmas tapes from the late 50s. I'm a little boy. And this pandemonium at Christmas time, my dad had a reel-to-reel tape, and you could hear everything in the room. And I'm thinking, that was not a shotgun mic.
No, no, not at all.
That was more like the first one.
Exactly.
All right, what other kind of microphones should we think about as we get ready for these things?
Okay, the next one I want to talk about is called a cardioid, which is basically, if you know anything about surgery, that's a heart. This microphone is a heart shape. So these have the heart-shaped pattern that kind of picks up like you would imagine a heart coming out from the microphone with a point going away from the microphone. And these are primarily for people where you're going to have people on the front and the sides, and they're widely used in handheld microphones. Like if you see somebody interviewing somebody on the news that's holding it out, it's that cardioid microphone because it's picking up the two people. They're not exactly straight to the front of it. They might be a little bit to the side. So it's kind of like a heart-shaped pattern. And so that's a great one to use if you're just interviewing a couple of people. So that's an awesome one for that. Now, there's another one that's called a super hypercardioid. And these are highly directional and record almost exclusively from the direction in which they are pointed, kind of like a pulled-in shotgun, so to speak. And these are found most often in the form of, we mentioned, shotgun microphones, which makes a directional good for like filmmaking, because usually when you're shooting a camera.
Probably too professional, though, for most people, right?
Yeah, well, it can be. Just kind of think what you see in the lens of your camera is basically what this microphone's going to see. So if somebody's talking to you on the side and saying, hey, you know, we need to do this, or hey, you know, I remember this story, whatever, they're not on film, so they're probably not going to be on audio either, unless they're really annoying like Aunt Martha. But otherwise, those are really good microphones, but you have to be really careful with them. There's a bidirectional one, which this pickup pattern records from both sides, but not so much for the top or the bottom.
So you'd put that, what, in the middle of a table between two people?
You could do that also. And I'm going to get to another kind of microphone that's actually better for a table situation. But the bidirectional type is most often between interview subjects or for recording music and vocals, particularly duets. So two people are standing kind of on the side of the microphone.
Okay, think Paul McCartney and George Harrison.
Exactly.
Ooh.
Yep,
yes.
Exactly. That's okay. Exactly what it is.
All right, where do you get these mics?
You can go any place. I always recommend go to bhaudio.com. They'll sit there and answer questions for you. If you want more research, go to videomaker.com, and there's great interviews and articles about what kind of mics to use.
All right, great stuff as always, Tom. Hopefully that answers your question, Jan. You can always ask Tom at tmcplace.com. Thanks for coming on.
See you next week.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us once again. That wraps up our show for this week. Thanks to Karen Clifford, who came on to talk about her knowledge of researching the South. And it sounds like if you've got Southern ancestry, you got a lot of things to learn about. Listen to the segment again. You can get our free podcast app for iPhone or Android. Just download it from your phone store and you can catch up on that. Also, thanks to Roy Scheffler from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, the man who loved cemeteries so much, he decided to buy one. Yeah, what a great story that was. Thanks again for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family. This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.